looked so sad.
Please, Your Grace.
Finolio could not conceal the anxiety in his voice.
It's much too soon. Wait a little longer.
But Cosimo only smiled. The moon is red, poet. The soothsayers think that's a good sign. A sign that we mustn't miss the moment, or all may come to grief. What nonsense. Finolio bowed his head to keep Cosimo from seeing the annoyance in his face. Cosimo knew anyway that his love of soothsayers and fortune-tellers irritated Finolio, who thought them all a set of avaricious frauds.
Let me say it once again, Your Grace.
He had repeated this warning so often that it was beginning to sound flat.
The only thing that will bring you bad luck is setting out too soon.
But Cosimo merely shook his head indulgently. You're an old man, Finolio, he said. Your blood flows slowly, but I'm young. What should I wait for? For the Adderhead to recruit mercenaries too and barricade himself in the Castle of Night?
He probably did that long ago, thought Finolio, and that's why you must wait for my words, and for Meggie to read them the way she read you here. Wait for her voice. Just 1 or 2 weeks more, Your Grace, he said urgently. Your peasants must bring in their harvest. What else will they have to live on in winter?
But Cosimo didn't want to hear about such things.
That truly is old man's talk, he said angrily. Where are your fiery words now? They'll live on the Adderhead's stores of provisions, on the good fortune of our victory, on the silver from the Castle of Night. I'll have it distributed in the villages.
They can't eat silver, Your Grace, thought Finolio,
but he did not say it aloud. Instead, he looked up at the sky. Dear God, how high the moon had risen already. But Cosimo still had something on his mind.
There's a question I've been meaning to ask you for some time, he said just as Finolio was about to take his leave with some stammered excuse. You're so friendly with the strolling players. Everyone's talking about that fire-eater, the one they say can talk to flames.
Out of the corner of his eye, Finolio saw Brianna bend her head.
You mean Dustfinger?
Yes, that's his name. I know he's Brianna's father, said Cosimo, casting her a loving glance. But she won't talk about him, and she says she doesn't know where he is now. But perhaps you do.
Cosimo patted his horse's neck. His face seemed to burn with beauty.
Why? What do you want of him?
Isn't that obvious? He can talk to fire. They say he can make the flames grow to a great height without burning him.
Finolio understood even before Cosimo explained.
You want Dustfinger for your war?
He couldn't help it. He laughed aloud.
What's so funny about that?
Cosimo frowned. Dustfinger the fire dancer as a weapon. Finolio shook his head.
Oh, no. I know Dustfinger very well.
He saw Brianna give him a look of surprise as he said so.
And he is many things, but certainly not a warrior. He'd laugh in your face.
He had better not.
There was no mistaking the anger in Cosimo's voice, but Brianna was looking at Finolio as if she had 1,000 questions on the tip of her tongue. Well, this was no time for them.
Your Highness, he said hastily, please excuse me now. One of Minerva's children is ill, and I promised to get a few words from Brianna's mother for her.
Oh, I see. Of course. Yes, of course. Ride on, and we'll talk later.
Cosimo gathered up his reins again.
If the child doesn't improve, let me know. I'll send a physician.
Thank you, said Finolio.
But before he finally went on his way, there was one question he himself had to ask.
I've heard your wife isn't well either.
Balbulus, who at present was the only visitor allowed to see Violante, had told him so.
Oh, she's just in a temper.
Cosimo took Brianna's hand as if to comfort her for the fact that they were talking about his wife.
Violante loses her temper easily. She gets it from her father. She simply will not understand why I won't let her leave the castle. Yet it's obvious that her father's informers are everywhere. And who would they try to pump for information first? Violante and Jacopo.
It was hard not to believe every word that those beautiful lips uttered, particularly when they spoke with so much genuine conviction.
Well, I expect you're right, but please, don't forget that your wife hates her father.
You can hate someone and obey him all the same. Isn't that so? Cosimo looked at Finolio with that naked expression in his eyes, like the eyes of a very young baby.
"Yes, probably," he replied uncomfortably.
Every time Cosimo looked at him like that, Finolio felt as if he had found an empty page in a book, a moth hole in the finely woven carpet of words.
"Your Highness,"
he said, bowing his head again, and finally, if not very elegantly, got his horse to trot out of the gateway. Brianna had given him a good description of the way to her mother's farmhouse. He had asked her about it after Roxanne's visit, apparently in all innocence, saying that he was plagued by aching bones. Dustfinger's daughter was a strange child. She wanted nothing to do with her father, and obviously not much with her mother either. Luckily, she had warned him about the goose, so he was holding the horse's reins firmly when the cackling bird came toward him. Roxanne was sitting outside her house when he rode into the yard. It was a poor place. Her beauty seemed to fit into it as little as a jewel in a beggar's hut. Her son was sleeping in the doorway beside her, curled up like a puppy, his head on her lap.
"You want to come with me?" she said as Finolio slid clumsily off the horse. "The little girl cried too when I told her I had to go away. But I can't take them, not to Argenta. The other heads had children hanged before now. A friend is going to look after the girl for me and Jehan, and the plants and animals too."
She stroked her son's dark hair, and for a moment Finolio didn't want her to ride away. But what would become of his words then? Who else would find Maggie? Should he ask Cosimo for another horseman who might not come back either?
"Well, who knows, maybe Roxanne won't come back," an insidious voice inside him whispered. "And then your precious words will be lost." "Nonsense," he said angrily out loud. "I made a copy, of course."
"What did you say?"
Roxanne looked at him in surprise.
"Oh, nothing, nothing." Heavens above, now he was talking to himself. "There's something else I have to tell you. Don't ride to the mill. A minstrel who sings for Cosimo has brought me news from the Black Prince."
Roxanne pressed her hand to her mouth.
No, it's not so bad," Finolio quickly reassured her. "The fact is, Maggie's father has obviously been taken prisoner by the Adahead, but to be honest, I feared as much. As for Dustfinger and Maggie, well, to be brief, the mill where Maggie was to wait for my letter seems to have burned down. Apparently, the miller is telling everyone that a marten made fire rain down from the roof while a wizard with a scarred face spoke to the flames. It seems this wizard had a demon with him in the shape of a dark-skinned boy who saved him when he was wounded and helped him and a girl to escape."
Roxanne looked at him with a thoughtful expression, as if she had to search for the meaning of what he had said.
"Wounded?" "Yes, but they escaped. That's the main thing. Roxanne, do you really think you can find them?"
She passed a hand over her forehead.
"I'll try."
"Don't worry," said Finolio. "You heard what they're saying. Dustfinger has a demon protecting him now. In any case, hasn't he always managed very well on his own?"
"Oh, yes, indeed he has."
Finolio cursed every wrinkle on his old face. She was so beautiful. Why didn't he have Cosimo's good looks? Although, would she like that? She liked Dustfinger, who ought to have been dead by now if the story had gone the way he had once written it.
"Finolio," he told himself, "this is going too far. You're behaving like a jealous lover."
But Roxanne was taking no notice of him anyway. She looked down at the boy sleeping in her lap.
"Brianna was furious when she heard that I was going to ride after her father," she said. "I only hope that Cosimo will look after her and won't begin his war before I get back."
Finolio made no reply to that. Why tell her about Cosimo's plans? To make her even more anxious? No. He took out the letter for Maggie from under his cloak. Written words that could become sound. A mighty sound. He had never before made Rosencourt seal a letter so carefully.
"This letter can save Maggie's parents," he said urgently. "It can save her father. It can save us all. So take good care of it."
Roxanne turned the sealed parchment this way and that, as if it seemed to her too small for such great claims.
I never heard of a letter that could open the dungeons of the Castle of Night, she said. Do you think it's right to give the girl false hopes?
They aren't false, said Finolio,
rather hurt to find that she had so little faith in his words.
Very well. If I find Dustfinger and the girl is still with him, she'll get your letter.
Roxanne stroked her son's hair again, very gently, as if to brush away a leaf.
Does she love her father?
Yes, she loves him very much.
My daughter loves hers, too. Rihanna loves him so much that she won't speak a word to him now. When he went away in the old days, when he just used to go into the forest or down to the sea anywhere that fire or wind happened to lure him, she would try to run after him on her little feet. I don't think he even noticed. He always disappeared so fast, as quick as a fox that has stolen a chicken. But she loved him all the same. Why? That boy loves him too. He even thinks Dustfinger needs him. But he needs no one, only fire.
Finolio looked thoughtfully at her.
You're wrong, he said. He was wretchedly unhappy when he was away. You should have seen him.
She eyed him incredulously.
You know where he was?
Now what? Old fool that he was. What did he say this time? Well, yes, he stammered. Yes, I was there myself.
He needed some lies, and where were they? The truth wasn't going to be much use this time. A few good lies were needed to explain everything. Why shouldn't he find a few good words for Dustfinger for a change, even if he envied him his wife?
He says he couldn't come back. She didn't believe it, but you could tell from Roxanne's voice how much she wished she did.
That's exactly how it was. He had a bad time. Capricorn set Basta on him. They took him far, far away and tried to make him tell them how to talk with fire.
Here came the lies now, and they might even be close to the truth. Who could say?
Believe me, Basta took his revenge for your preference for Dustfinger. They shut him away for years, and he finally escaped. But they soon found him, and they beat him half to death.
Meggie had told him that part. A little of the truth couldn't hurt, and Roxanne didn't have to know that it was because of Risa.
It was dreadful, dreadful.
Finolio felt the pleasure of storytelling run away with him, the pleasure of watching Roxanne's eyes widening as she hung on his lips, waiting eagerly for his next words. Should he make Dustfinger a little villainous after all?
No, he killed him once already. He'd do him a favor today. He would make his wife forgive him, once and for all, for staying away those 10 years.
Sometimes I truly can be a benevolent person, thought Finolio.
He thought he'd die. He thought he'd never see you again. And that was the worst of it for him.
Finolio had to clear his throat. He was moved by his own words, and so was Roxanne.
Oh, yes. He saw the distrust disappear from her eyes. He saw them soften with love.
After that, he wandered in strange lands like a dog turned out of doors looking for a way that would take him not to Basta, a Capricorn, but to you.
The words were coming of their own accord now, as if he really knew what Dustfinger had felt all those years.
He was forlorn, truly forlorn. His heart was cold as a stone from loneliness. There was no room in it for anything but longing. Longing for you. And for his daughter.
He had two daughters.
Roxanne's voice was almost inaudible.
Damn it, he'd forgotten that. Two daughters, of course, but Roxanne was so wrapped with his words that his mistake didn't break the spell.
How do you know all this? She asked. You never told me you knew each other so well.
No one knows him better, thought Finolio. I can assure you, my beauty, no one knows him better.
Roxanne pushed her black hair back away from her face. Finolio saw a trace of gray in it, as if she had combed it with a dusty comb.
I shall ride early in the morning, she said.
Excellent.
Finolio drew his horse to his side. Why was it so difficult to get onto these creatures with anything like elegance?
Look after yourself, he said when he was finally on the horse's back. And the letter, too. And give Maggie my love. Tell her everything will be all right. I promise.
As he rode away, she stood beside her sleeping son, looking thoughtful, and watched him go. He really did hope she would find Dustfinger. and it wasn't just that he wanted Maggie to get his words. No, a little happiness in this story couldn't hurt, and Roxanne was not happy without Dustfinger. That was the way he'd fixed it.
He didn't deserve her all the same,
thought Fenolio again as he rode toward the lights of Ombra, which were neither as bright nor as many as the lights of his old world, but were at least equally inviting. Soon the houses behind the protecting walls would be without their menfolk. They would all be going with Cosimo, including Minerva's husband, although she had begged him to stay, and the cobbler whose workshop was next to his. Even the rag collector who went around every Tuesday was going to fight the Adderhead. Would they follow Cosimo as willingly if I'd made him ugly? Fenolio wondered. Ugly's the Adderhead with his butcher's face? No. People find it easier to believe that a man with a handsome face has good intentions, so he had done well to put an angel on the throne. Yes, that was clever. Extremely clever. Fenolio caught himself humming quietly as the horse carried him past the guards. They let him in without a word, their prince's poet, the man who had put their world into words and had made it out of words.
Bow your heads to Fenolio.
The guards would go with Cosimo, too, and the soldiers up in the castle, and the grooms who were hardly as old as the boy who went around with Dustfinger. Even Minerva's son, Ivo, would have gone if she had let him. They'll all come back, thought Fenolio, as he rode toward the stables. Or most of them, at least. It will end well. I know it will. Not just well, but very well indeed. Chapter 52 Angry Orpheus. Eleanor lay on her air mattress staring at the ceiling. She had quarreled with Orpheus again, even though she knew she'd be punished with the cellar.
Sent to bed early, Eleanor, she thought bitterly.
That was how her father used to punish her as a child when he caught her yet again with a book that he didn't think she should be reading at her age. Sent to bed early, sometimes at 5 in the afternoon. It had been particularly bad in summer when the birds were singing and her sister was playing outside under the window. Her sister, who didn't care for books at all, but liked nothing so much as telling tales on Eleanor when, instead of playing with her, she had buried her head in a book that her father had said she mustn't read.
Eleanor, please don't quarrel with Orpheus.
Darius had tried drumming that into her so often, but no, she just couldn't control her temper. How could she be expected to, when his wretched dog slobbered all over some of her most valuable books because his master never thought of putting them back on their shelves after he'd had his fun with them? Recently, however, he hadn't been taking any more books off the shelves. Not one. That, at least, was a small comfort.
He just reads Inkheart.
Darius had whispered to her as they were washing the dishes together in the kitchen. Her dishwasher had broken down. As if it wasn't bad enough to be working as a kitchen maid in her own house, now her hands were all swollen with washing up water.
He seems to be looking for words, Darius whispered. He puts them together differently, writes them down, and writes. The waste paper basket is brimming over. He keeps on trying. And he reads what he's written out loud? And when nothing happens?
Yes, then what?
Oh, nothing,
Darius had said evasively, scrubbing away industriously at a pan encrusted with fat. But Eleanor knew that if it was nothing, he wouldn't have turned so embarrassed and silent.
Then what?
She repeated, and Darius, blushing to his ears, had finally told her. Then Orpheus threw her books, her wonderful books, at the walls. He flung them on the floor in his rage. Now and then one even sailed out of the window, and all because he couldn't do what Maggie had done. Inkheart was closed to him. However lovingly he cooed and implored in his velvety voice, reading and re-reading the sentences he so longed to slip between. Of course she had run straight off when she next heard him shouting. She'd gone to save her printed children.
No!
Orpheus had yelled so loudly that you could hear him in the kitchen.
No, no, no! Let me in, you thrice-accursed thing! I sent Dustfinger back to you! Can't you understand that? What would you be without him? I gave you back Mortola and Basta! I've earned my reward, haven't I?
The man built like a wardrobe wasn't standing outside the library door to stop Eleanor. He was probably roaming the house yet again to see if he could find something worth stealing after all. Not in 100 years would it have occurred to him that the books were by far the most valuable things in the place. Later, Eleanor couldn't remember the name she had called Orpheus. She remembered only the book he was holding in his raised hand, a beautiful edition of the poems of William Blake. And for all her furious insults, he threw it out of the window while the wardrobe man grabbed her from behind and dragged her to the cellar stairs.
Oh, Maggie,
thought Eleanor as she lay on the air mattress, staring up at the crumbling plaster on her cellar ceiling.
Why didn't you take me with you? Why didn't you at least ask if I'd like to come too?
Chapter 53. The Barn Owl. The sea. Maggie hadn't seen it since the day they drove back from Capricorn's village to Eleanor's house with the fairies and brownies who were nothing but ashes now.
"This is where the physician whom I told you about lives," said Dustfinger when the bay appeared beyond the trees.
It was beautiful. The sun made the water shimmer like green glass, foaming glass constantly shaped by the wind into new folds. It was a strong wind driving veils of cloud over the blue sky, and it carried a scent of salt and distant islands. It would have gladdened the heart but for the bare hill in the distance rising above the wooded slopes, and the castle on top of the hill, broad and heavy as its master's face, in spite of its silvered rooftops and battlements.
"Yes, there it is," said Dustfinger when he saw Maggie's look of alarm. "The castle at night. And the hill where it stands is called Mount Adder. What else? Bare as an old man's bald head, so no one can come close under the cover of trees. But don't worry, it's not quite as close as it looks."
"The towers," said Farid. "Are they really all pure silver?"
"Oh, yes," said Dustfinger.
"Dug from the mountains, this one and others. Roast fowls, young women, fertile land, and silver. The Adderhead has a hearty appetite for many things."
A broad sandy beach edged the bay. Where joined the trees, a long wall and a tower rose, sand-colored and inconspicuous. There was not a soul to be seen on the beach. No boat was drawn up on the pale sand, only that building, the low tower and the long tiled rooftops hardly visible behind the wall. A path wound toward it like a viper's trail. But Dustfinger led them around the back of the building under the cover of the trees. He beckoned impatiently to them before disappearing into the shadow of the wall. The wood of the door outside which he was waiting for them was weathered, and the bell hanging above it was rusty with the salty wind. Wild flowers grew near the door, faded blossoms and brown seed heads with a fairy nibbling at them. She had paler skin than her woodland sisters. It all seemed so peaceful. The buzz of a wasp reached Maggie's ear, mingling with the roaring of the sea. But she remembered only too well how peaceful the mill had looked. Dustfinger had not forgotten it either. He stood there listening intently, before he finally put out his hand and pulled the chain of the rusty bell. His leg was bleeding again, and Maggie saw him press his hand to it. But nonetheless, he had kept urging them on to make haste on their way to this place. "There's no better physician," was all he would say when Farid asked where he was taking them. "And none we can trust more. In addition, it's not far from the castle at night, and that's where Maggie still wants to go, doesn't she?" He had given them some leaves to eat, downy and bitter. "Get them down inside you," he said when they made faces of disgust. "You can stay where we're going only if you have at least 5 of them in your belly." The wooden door opened just a crack, and a woman peered through.
"By all good spirits,"
Maggie heard her whisper, and then the door opened and a thin, wrinkled hand beckoned them in. The woman who quickly closed it behind them again was just as wrinkled and thin as her hand, and she stared at Dustfinger as if he had fallen straight from heaven.
yesterday. He said so yesterday,
she exclaimed.
You wait and see, Bella. He's back, that's what he said. Who else could have set the mill ablaze? Who else tokes the fire? He didn't get a wink of sleep all night. He was worried, but you're all right, aren't you? What's the matter with your leg?
Dustfinger put a finger to his mouth, but Maggie saw that he was smiling.
It could be better, he said quietly. I know you talk as fast as ever, Bella, but could you take us to the barn owl now?
Yes, okay, of course.
Bella sounded slightly injured.
I suppose you have that horrible Martin in there?
She inquired with a distrustful look at Dustfinger's backpack.
Don't you go letting him out?
Of course not, Dustfinger assured her, casting a glance at Fareed, which obviously warned him to say nothing about the second Martin asleep in his own backpack.
Without another word, the old woman beckoned to them to follow her down a dark, unadorned colonnade. She took small, hasty footsteps, as if she were a squirrel, wearing a long dress of coarsely woven fabric.
A good thing you came around the back way,
she said in a lowered voice, as she led them past a series of closed doors.
I'm afraid the Adderhead has ears even here now, but luckily he doesn't pay his informers well enough for them to work in the wing where we treat infectious cases. I hope you gave those two enough of the leaves.
Yes, indeed, Dustfinger nodded, but Maggie saw he looked around uneasily and inconspicuously put another of the leaves that he had given them into his own mouth.
Not until they passed the fragile figures sunning themselves in the courtyard around which the colonnade ran did Maggie realize just where Dustfinger had brought them. It was an infirmary. Fareed put his hand to his mouth in horror when they met an old man who looked as pale as if death had come for him long ago, and he replied to the man's toothless smile with only a frightened nod.
"Don't look as if you were about to fall down dead,"
Dustfinger whispered to him, although he didn't look particularly comfortable here either.
"Your fingers will be well tended here, and moreover will be relatively safe, which is more than can be said for many places on this side of the forest."
"Yes, if there's one thing the Adderhead fears," added Bella in knowing tones, "it's death and the diseases that lead to it. All the same, you shouldn't let either the patients or the nurses here see you more than they must. If there's one thing I've learned in life, it's never to trust anyone. Except the barn owl, of course."
What about me, Bella? Asked Dustfinger.
Oh, you least of all,
was her only reply. She stopped at a plain wooden door.
It's a pity your face is so unmistakable,
she told Dustfinger, low-voiced.
Or you could have put on a show for a patience. Nothing does the sick more good than a little pleasure.
Then she knocked on the door, and with a nod, stepped aside. The room on the other side of the door was dark, for the only window was half hidden behind stacks of books. It was the kind of room Mo would have loved. He liked books to look as if someone had only just put them down. Quite unlike Eleanor, he saw nothing wrong in leaving them there lying open, waiting for the next reader. The barn owl seemed to feel the same. He could hardly be spotted among all those piled books, small man with short-sighted eyes and broad hands. He looked to Maggie like a mole, except that his hair was gray.
"Didn't I say so?"
He knocked two books off their stacks as he hurried toward Dustfinger.
"He's back," I said, "but they wouldn't believe it. Obviously the white women are letting more and more of the dead come back to life these days."
The two men embraced. Then the barn owl took a step back and looked Dustfinger thoroughly up and down. The physician was an old man, older than Fenolio, but his eyes were as young as Fareed's.
"Eh, you look all right,"
he commented, pleased.
"Set for your leg. What's the matter with it? Did you get that injury at the mill? One of my women healers was taken up to the castle yesterday to tend to two men bitten by fire. She brought back a strange story about an ambush and an horned marten that spits fire."
Up to the castle? Instinctively, Maggie moved toward the physician. "Did she see the prisoners, too?" she interrupted him. "They would just have been taken there. Strolling players, men and women. My mother and father are with them." The barn owl looked at her sympathetically.
"Are you the girl that the Black Prince's men told me about?
Your father is the man they take for the Blue Jay," Dustfinger finished the sentence. "Do you know how he and the other prisoners are?"
Before the barn owl could answer, a girl put her head around the door. She stared at the strangers in alarm. Her eyes lingered on Maggie so long that finally the barn owl cleared his throat.
What is it, Carla?
He asked. The girl bit her pale lips nervously.
I'm to ask if we have any eyebright left,
she said timidly.
Of course, go to Bella and she'll give you some, but now leave us alone.
The girl disappeared with a hasty nod, but she left the door open. Sighing, the barn owl closed it and then bolted it, too.
Where were we? Oh, yes, the prisoners. The physician responsible for the dungeons is looking after him. He's useless at his job, but who else could stand it up there? Instead of healing the sick, he has to preside over weapons and lashings. Luckily, they're not letting him near your father, and the Arrowhead's own physician isn't going to soil his fingers on a prisoner. So my best woman healer goes up to the castle every day to tend him.
How is my father?
Maggie tried not to sound like a little girl holding back her tears with difficulty, but she didn't entirely succeed.
He's badly wounded, but I think you know that.
Maggie nodded, and the tears came again, flowing and flowing as if to wash it all out of her heart. Her grief, her longing, her fear. Fareed put his arm around her shoulders, but that just reminded her of Mo even more. Of all the years he had protected her and held her close. And now that he was in trouble, she wasn't with him.
He's lost a great deal of blood, and he's still weak, but he's doing well. Much better anyway than we let the Arrowhead know.
You could tell from the barn owl's voice that he often had to talk to people who were anxious about those they loved.
My healer has advised him not to let anyone notice, to give us more time. But at the moment, there really is nothing for you to worry about.
Maggie's heart soared.
It will be all right,
something inside her said for the first time since Dustfinger had given her Reese's note.
Everything will be all right.
Feeling embarrassed, she wiped the tears off her face.
That weapon that wounded your father. My healer says it must be a terrible thing,
the barn owl continued.
I hope the Arrowhead's armorers are not working on some diabolical invention in secret.
No, that weapon was from a very different place. And nothing good comes from that place, said Dustfinger's face.
But Maggie didn't want to think of what a gun could do to this world just now. Her thoughts were with Mo.
My father, she told the barn owl, would like this room very much. He loves books, and yours are really beautiful.
Although he'd probably tell you that some of them needed rebinding, and
that one won't live much longer if you don't do something about the beetles eating it.
The barn owl picked up the book she had pointed out and caressed the pages just as Mo always did.
The blue jay loves books?
He asked.
Unusual for a robber.
He's not a robber, said Maggie. He's a doctor, like you. Only he heals books instead of people.
Really? Then is it true that the Adderhead had captured the wrong man? In that case, I suppose when they say your father killed Capricorn, that isn't true either.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Dustfinger looked out of the window as if he saw the scene of Capricorn's festivities outside. And all he needed to do it was his voice.
You ought to get him or his daughter to read you sometime. Afterward, I assure you, you'll see your books in a very different light. You might well close and padlock them.
Really?
The barn owl looked at Maggie with great interest, as if he would like to hear more about Capricorn's death, but there was another knock. This time a man's voice came through the bolted door.
Will you come, master? We prepared everything, but it will be better if you make the incision.
Maggie saw Fareed turn pale.
Just coming, said the barn owl. You go ahead. I hope I can welcome your father to this room someday,
he said to Maggie as he went to the door.
For you're right. My books could certainly do with a doctor. Does the Black Prince have any plans for the prisoners?
He looked inquiringly at Dustfinger.
No, I don't think so. Have you heard anything about the other captives? Maggie's mother is among them.
It gave Maggie a pang that Dustfinger, and not she, had been the one to ask about Risa.
No, I don't know anything about the others,
replied the barn owl.
But now you must excuse me. I'm sure Bella's already told you that you'd better keep to this part of the building. The Arrowhead is spending more and more of his silver on informers. No place in Argenta's safe from them. Not even this one.
I know.
Dustfinger picked up one of the books lying on the barn owl's table. It was an herbal. Maggie could imagine how Eleanor would have looked at it, full of longing to own it. And Mo would have run a finger over the painted pages as if he could feel the brush that had conjured up the fine lines of the pictures on paper. But what was Dustfinger thinking of? The herbs in Roxanne's fields?
Believe me, I wouldn't have come here but for what happened at the mill, he said. No one would want to bring danger to this place. But we'll be gone again this very day.
However, the barn owl wouldn't hear of it.
Nonsense, you must stay until your leg and the boy's fingers are better, he said. You know how glad I am you came, and I'm glad you have the boy with you, too. Did you know?
He asked, turning to Farid.
He has never had a pupil before. I was always telling him that a master must pass on his art, but he wouldn't listen to me. I pass mine on to many, and that's why I must leave you now. I have to show a pupil how to cut off a foot without killing the man it's attached to.
Farid stared at him, horrified.
Cut it off? He whispered. How do you mean cut it off?
But the barn owl had already closed the door behind him.
Didn't I tell you? Said Dustfinger, feeling his injured thigh.
The barn owl's a first-class sawbones, but I think we'll be allowed to keep our own fingers and feet.
After Bella had treated Farid's blisters and Dustfinger's leg, she took them to a remote room close to the door through which they had entered the building. Maggie liked the prospect of sleeping under a roof again, but Farid was not at all comfortable with the idea. Looking unhappy, he squatted on the lavender-strewn floor, chewing one of the bitter leaves with determination.
"Can we sleep on the beach tonight? I should think the sun would be nice and soft,"
he asked Dustfinger, who was stretching out on one of the straw mattresses.
"Or in the forest?"
"If you like," replied Dustfinger. "But let me sleep now, and stop looking as if I brought you among cannibals, or I won't show you what I promised tomorrow night."
"Tomorrow?"
Farid spat out the leaf into his hand.
"Why not tonight?"
"Because it's too windy now," said Dustfinger, turning his back on him. "And because my damn leg hurts. Do you need any more reasons?"
Remorsefully, Farid shook his head, put the leaf back in his mouth, and stared at the door as if death in person might walk in any moment. But Maggie just sat there in the bare room, repeating to herself, over and over, what the barn owl had said about Mo.
"He's doing well. Much better anyway than we let the other head know. At the moment, there really is nothing for you to worry about."
When twilight fell, Dustfinger limped outside. He leaned against a column and looked up at the hill where the Castle of Night stood. Never moving, he gazed at the silver towers. And Maggie asked herself, for what was surely the 100th time, if he was helping her only for her mother's sake. Perhaps Dustfinger himself didn't know. Chapter 54 In the Dungeon of the Castle of Night. Mina was crying again. Risa took the other woman in her arms as if she were still a child, hummed a tune, and rocked her as she sometimes rocked Maggie, although by now her daughter was almost as tall as Risa herself. A girl came twice a day, a thin, nervous little thing younger than Maggie, to bring them bread and water. Sometimes there was porridge, too, cold and sticky, but it filled the stomach, and reminded Risa of the days when Mortola had locked her up for something she had or hadn't done. The porridge had tasted just like this. When she asked the girl about the blue jay, the child just ducked her head in fright and left Risa in fear, the fear that Mo was dead by now, that they had hanged him up there in the huge courtyard, and the last thing he had seen in this world was not her face, but the silver vipers' heads with their tongues licking down from the walls. Sometimes she saw it all so clearly in her mind's eye that she put her hands over her eyes, but the pictures were still there, and the darkness around her made her think it could have all been a dream. That moment at Capricorn's festivities, when she had suddenly seen Mo standing beside Maggie, the year in Eleanor's house. All that happiness. Just a dream. At least she was not alone. Even if the glances of the others were often hostile, their voices brought her out of her dark thoughts for a brief while. Now and then someone told a story to keep them from hearing the weeping from the other cells, the scurrying of rats, the screams.
the stammering voices that had long since ceased to make sense. Usually it was the women who told stories. Stories of love and death, betrayal and friendship. But they all ended happily, lights in the darkness, like the candles in Risa's pocket with wicks that had now become damp. Risa told fairy tales that Mo had read aloud to her long, long ago, when Meggie's fingers were still soft and tiny, and the written word held no terrors for any of them yet. As for the strolling players, they told tales of the world around them, of Cosimo the Fair and his battle with the Fire Raisers, of the Black Prince and how he found his bear, and his friend the Fire Dancer, the man who made sparks rain down and fiery flowers blossom in the darkest night. Benedicta sang a song about him in a soft voice, a beautiful song, and in the end, even Two Fingers joined in, until the warder banged his stick against the bars and told them to keep quiet.
"I saw him once," whispered Benedicta when the warder had gone away again. "Many years ago, when I was a little girl, it was wonderful. The fire was so bright that even my eyes could see it. They say he's dead."
"No, he isn't," said Risa quietly. "Who do you think made the tree across the road burn?" They looked at her so incredulously, but she was too tired to tell them any more. She was too tired to explain anything. "Let me go to my husband." That was all she wanted to say. "Let me go to my child. Don't tell me any more stories. Tell me how they are. Please." Someone did at last give her news of Maggie and Mo, but Risa would rather have heard it from any other mouth. The others were asleep when Mortola came. She had two soldiers with her. Risa was awake because she was seeing those pictures again. Pictures of Mo being brought into the courtyard, having a rope put around his neck.
"He's dead, and she's come to tell me."
That was her first thought when the magpie stood before her with a triumphant smile.
"Well, well, here's our faithless maid," said Mortola as Risa got to her feet with difficulty. "You seem to be as much of a witch as your daughter. How have you kept him alive? Perhaps I took aim a little too hastily. Never mind. A few more weeks and he'll be strong enough for his execution." "Alive." Risa turned her head away so that Mortola wouldn't see the smile that stole over her lips. But the magpie was not looking at her face. She was enjoying the sight of her torn dress and bleeding bare feet.
"The blue jay," Mortola lowered her voice. "Of course, I haven't told the Adderhead that he's going to execute the wrong man. Why should I? It's all working out just as I wanted. And I shall get my hands on your daughter, too."
"Maggie." The sense of happiness that had briefly warmed Reese's heart disappeared as suddenly as it had come. Beside her, Mina sat up, woken by Mortola's hoarse voice.
"Oh, yes. I have powerful friends in this world," continued the magpie with a self-satisfied smile. "The other head has caught me your husband. Why wouldn't he catch me your witch of a daughter, too? Do you know how I have convinced him that she is a witch? By showing him a photograph of her. Yes, Risa, I let Buster take the photos of your little darling with him, all those pretty silver-framed photographs standing around the bookworm woman's house. Of course, the other head thinks that the magic pictures, mirror images captured on paper. His soldiers are afraid to touch them, but they're showing them around all over the place. A pity we can't duplicate them as we would in your world. But fortunately, your daughter has joined forces with Dustfinger, and there's no need for any magic picture of him. Every peasant has heard of him. Him and his scars."
"He'll protect her," said Risa. She had to say something.
"Oh, yes. The way he protected you."
Risa dug her fingers into the fabric of her dirty dress. There was no one in either this or the other world that she hated as much as the magpie. Not even Basta. It was Mortola who had taught her how to hate. "Everything is different here," she managed to say. "Fire obeys him here, and he's not alone as he was in the other world. He has friends."
"Friends," Ah, I suppose you mean the other mountebanks, the Black Prince, as he calls himself, and the rest of that rabble?
Contemptuously, the magpie scanned the other prisoners. They had almost all woken up.
Look at them, Risa, said Mortola spitefully. How are they going to help you out of here? With a few brightly colored balls or a couple of sentimental songs? One of them gave you away. Did you know that? And as for Dustfinger, what could he do? Unleash fire to save you? It would burn you too, and he certainly won't risk that, besotted with you as he always was.
She leaned forward with a smile.
Did you ever tell your husband what good friends you two were?
Risa did not reply. She knew Mortola's games. She knew them very well.
What do you think? Shall I tell him?
Mortola whispered, ready to pounce, like a cat waiting by a mouse hole.
Do that, Risa whispered back. Tell him. You can't tell him anything he doesn't know already. I've given him back the years you stole from us, word for word, day after day. And Mo knows, too, that your own son made you live in his cellar and let everyone think you were only his housekeeper.
Mortola tried to hit her in the face as she had so often done before, as she had done to all her maids, right in the middle of the face. But Risa caught her hand before it landed.
He's alive, Mortola, she whispered to the magpie. This story isn't over yet, and his death isn't written anywhere in it. But my daughter will whisper yours in your ear when she hears what you did to her father. You'll see one day, and then I shall watch you die.
This time she didn't manage to catch Mortola's hand, and her cheek was still burning long after the magpie had gone away. She felt the eyes of the other prisoners like fingers feeling her face when she was sitting on the cold ground again. Mina was the first to say something.
Where did you meet the old woman? She mixed poisons for Capricorn.
I know, said Risa tonelessly. I belonged to her for many long years. Chapter 55. A Letter from Finolio. Dustfinger was asleep when Roxanne arrived. It was already growing dark outside. Farid and Meggie had gone out to the beach, but he was lying down because his leg was hurting. When he saw Roxanne standing in the doorway, he thought at first his imagination was playing tricks on him, as it so often did by night. After all, he had once been here with her, very long ago. The room they had then had looked almost the same, and he had been lying on a straw mattress just like this, his face slashed and sticky with his own blood. Roxanne was wearing her hair loose. Perhaps that's why she woke the memory of that other night. His heart always seemed to miss a beat at the mere thought of it. He had been mad with pain and fear, had crawled away like a wounded animal, until Roxanne found him and brought him here. At first the barn owl had hardly recognized him. He had given him something to drink that made him sleep. And when he woke again, Roxanne had been standing in the doorway, just as she was standing now. When the cuts would not heal, for all the physician's skill, she had gone into the forest with him, deeper and deeper into the forest to find the fairies. And she had stayed with him until his face was healed well enough for him to venture among other people again. There could be few men whose love for a woman had been written on his face with a knife. But what was his greeting when she suddenly appeared?
What are you doing here?
He asked. Then he could have bitten off his tongue. Why didn't he say how much he had missed her, so much that he had almost turned back a dozen times?
Yes, indeed, what am I doing here?
Roxanne asked back. Once she would have just turned her back on him for such a question, but now she just smiled, so mockingly that he felt as awkward as a boy.
Where have you left Jihan?
With a friend.
She kissed him.
What's the matter with your leg? Finolio told me you are wounded.
It's getting better. What do you have to do with Finolio?
You don't like him? Why not?
Roxanne stroked his face.
How beautiful she looked. So very beautiful.
Let's just say that he had plans for me that I didn't care for in the least. Has the old man by any chance given you something for Maggie? A letter, for instance.
Without a word, she brought it out from under her cloak. There the words were.
words that wanted to come true. Roxanne offered him the sealed parchment, but Dustfinger shook his head. "You better give that to Maggie," he said. "She's down on the beach."
Roxanne glanced at him in surprise.
"You look almost as if you were afraid of that piece of parchment."
"Yes," said Dustfinger, reaching for her hand. "Yes, I am, particularly when Finolio's been writing on it. Come on, let's go look for Maggie."
Maggie smiled awkwardly at Roxanne when she gave her the parchment, and for a moment looked curiously from her to Dustfinger, but then she had eyes only for Finolio's letter. She broke the seal so hastily that she almost tore the parchment. There were 3 closely written sheets. The first was a letter to her. When she had read it, Maggie put it away under her belt, paying it no further attention. The word she had been so eagerly waiting for filled the other 2 sheets. Maggie's eyes traveled over the lines so fast that Dustfinger could hardly believe she was really reading them. Finally, she raised her head, looked up at the Castle of Night, and smiled.
"Well, what does the old devil say?" asked Dustfinger.
Maggie offered him the 2 sheets. "It's different from what I expected. Quite different. But it's good. Here, read it for yourself."
Gingerly, he took the parchment in his fingertips, as if he might burn himself on it more easily than on a flame.
"When did you learn to read?"
Roxanne's voice sounded so surprised that he had to smile.
"Maggie's mother taught me."
Fool! Why was he telling her that? Roxanne gave Maggie a long look as he labored to decipher Finolio's handwriting. Reese had usually written in capital letters to make it easier for him.
"It could work, couldn't it?"
Maggie was looking over his shoulder. The sea roared as if to agree with her. Yes, perhaps it really would work. Dustfinger followed the written words like a dangerous path, but it was a path, and it led right into the middle of the Adderhead's heart. However, Dustfinger didn't like the part the old man intended Maggie to play. After all, her mother had asked him to take care of her. Fareed looked unhappily at the letters. He still couldn't read. Sometimes Dustfinger felt that he suspected those tiny black signs of witchcraft. What else could he think of them, indeed, after all his experiences?
"Come on."
Fareed shifted impatiently from foot to foot.
"What's he written?"
"Maggie will have to go to the castle, straight into the adder's nest."
"What?"
Horrified, the boy looked first at him and then at the girl.
"But that's impossible."
He took Maggie by the shoulders and turned her roughly around to face him.
"You can't go there. It's much too dangerous."
Poor boy. Of course she would go.
"That's the way Finolio has written it," she said, removing Farid's hands from her shoulders.
"Leave her alone," said Dustfinger, giving Maggie the sheets of parchment back.
"When are you going to read it aloud?"
"Now."
Of course. She didn't want to lose any time. And why should she? The sooner the story took a new turn, the better. It could hardly get worse. Or could it?
"What's all this about?"
Roxanne looked from one to another of them baffled. She scrutinized Fareed without much friendliness. She still didn't like him. Dustfinger thought that wouldn't change until something convinced her that Fareed was not his son.
"Explain," she said. "Finolio said that this letter would save her parents. But what can a letter do for someone in the dungeon in the Castle of Night?"
Dustfinger stroked her hair back. He liked to see her wearing it loose again. "Listen," he said, "I know it's difficult to believe, but if anything can open the dungeon doors of the Castle of Night, it's this letter. And Maggie's voice. She can make the ink live and breathe, Roxanne, just as you can bring a song to life. Her father has the same gift. If the Adderhead knew that, then I imagine he'd have hanged him long ago. The words that Maggie's father used to kill Capricorn look just as harmless as these." The way she was looking at him, as incredulously as she used to when he had yet again tried to explain where he had been for weeks on end.
"You mean magic? An ink spell?" she whispered.
"No, I mean reading aloud." She didn't understand a word of this, of course, which was not surprising. Perhaps she would if she heard Maggie read, if she saw the words suddenly trembling in the air, if she could smell them, feel them on her skin.
"I'd like to be alone when I read it," said Maggie, looking at Fareed. Then she turned and went back to the infirmary with Finolio's letter in her hand. Fareed wanted to follow her, but Dustfinger detained him.
"Let her," he said. "Do you think she'll disappear into the words? That's nonsense. We're all up to our necks in the story she's going to read anyway. She only wants to make sure the wind changes, and it will, if the old man has written the right words."
Chapter 56 The Wrong Ears. Roxanne brought Maggie an oil lamp before leaving her alone in the room where they would be sleeping.
"Written words need light. That's the awkward thing about them," she said. "But if these words are really as important as you all say, I can understand that you want to read them alone. I've always thought my singing voice sounds best when I'm on my own, too."
She was already in the doorway when she added,
"Your mother, do she and Dustfinger know each other well?"
Maggie almost replied, "I don't know. I've never asked my mother." But at last she said,
"They were friends."
She did not mention the resentment she still felt when she thought of how Dustfinger had known where Risa was all those years, and hadn't told Mo. But Roxanne asked no more questions anyway.
"If you need any help," was all she said before she left the room, "you'll find me with the barn owl."
Maggie waited until her footsteps along the dark corridor had died away. Then she sat down on one of the straw mattresses and put the sheets of parchment on her lap. What would it be like? She couldn't help thinking as the words lay spread out before her. Simply to do it for fun, just once. What would it be like to feel the magic of the words on her tongue when it wasn't a matter of life or death, good or bad luck? Once, in Eleanor's house, she had been almost unable to resist that temptation when she had seen a book that she'd loved as a small child. A book with mice in frilly dresses and tiny suits making jam and going for picnics. She had stopped the first word from forming on her lips by closing the book, though, because she'd suddenly seen some dreadful pictures in her mind. One of the dressed-up mice in Eleanor's garden surrounded by its wild relations, who would never in a million years dream of making jam. And an image of a little frilly dress, complete with a gray tail, in the jaws of one of the cats that regularly roamed among Eleanor's rhododendron bushes. Maggie had never brought anything out of the words on the page just for fun, and she wasn't going to do it this evening either.
"The whole secret, Maggie," Mo had once told her, "is in the breathing. It gives your voice strength, and it fills it with your life, and not just yours. Sometimes it feels as if when you take a breath, you're breathing in everything around you, everything that makes up the world and moves it, and then it all flows into the words." She tried it. She tried to breathe as calmly and deeply as the sea. The sound of the surf came into the room from outside, in and out, in and out, as if she could capture its power in her voice. The oil lamp that Roxanne had brought in filled the bare room with warm light, and outside one of the women healers walked softly by.
"I'm just going on with the story," whispered Maggie. "I'm just going on with the story. That's what it's waiting for. Come on."
She pictured the massive figure of the Adderhead pacing sleeplessly up and down in the castle of night, never guessing that there was a girl who planned to whisper his name in Death's ear this very night. She took the letter that Finolio had written her from her belt. It was as well that Dustfinger hadn't read it.
"Dear Maggie," it said, "I hope that what I'm sending you won't disappoint you. It's odd, but I have found that obviously I can write only what doesn't contradict anything I wrote about the Inkworld earlier. I have to keep the rules I made myself, even though I often made them unconsciously. I hope your father is all right. From what I hear, he is now a prisoner in the Castle of Night, and I must admit that I am not entirely blameless there. Yes, I admit it. After all, as you will have found out by now,
I used him as a living model for the Blue Jay. I am sorry, but I really did think it was a good idea at the time. He made an excellent and noble robber in my imagination, and how could I guess that he would ever really come into my story? Well, be that as it may, he's here, and the